What inspires you? For artist and provocateur David Ford, it's collaborations with non-artists that he finds most interesting.
I'm really turned on by what happens in the world. You know, I went through my travel or otherwise. I've worked with demolition derbies and strippers and preachers and Mayan shaman and African-American drill teams and a wide range of collaborations.
I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we'll hear about Ford's experience traveling to West Africa earlier this year for National Voodoo Day and how he incorporated that experience into his new solo show at the Dolphin Gallery. But first, a look at the Children's Defense Fund's Freedom School program here in KC and how they're working to reach and teach children left behind with a focus on literacy. That's all ahead on Central Standard following this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. Coming from a long line of what he calls prairie people, David Ford is the quintessence of politically incorrect, and this is exemplified through his works over the years. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Keeping with that tradition of politically incorrect, David Ford's solo exhibition, I Like African Chicken, runs April 27th through June 23rd, 2012, at the Dolphin Gallery in the Stockyards District of the West Bottoms. Welcome to Central Standard, David Ford.
I appreciate it.
Now, tell us about this exhibit, I Like African Chicken.
This is my third solo exhibit with the Dolphin Gallery, and a great deal of work references my studies after a recent trip to West Africa in January of this year.
Tell us about why you decided to name it that.
Well, you know, I
like African chicken.
Well, I like African chicken. You know, I was in a...
What does that even mean?
Well, the title came from, I'm sitting in a restaurant and I've been speaking French for a week or two and my French is horrible. And every once in a while, as people that travel know, they'll just utter something out in their native tongue because they know no one's under... And I said, man, this is good, man. I really like this. I like African chicken. This is... And it was tasty, you know, and it was very different. And I run a restaurant and I'm involved in a number of different kinds of arts, and it really stood out to me. And I immediately also had to self-check because it's such a politically incorrect phrase. It's an examination or an overgeneralization of a very complex series of societies I was in.
And you approach this exhibit, as well as most of your other exhibits, with an incredibly politically incorrect bent. Tell us about
that.
Well,
I mean, it's not intentional. I intend to ask questions. You know, I don't necessarily want to answer questions on the canvas. I'd like people to do their own exploring on it. But oftentimes, the real censorship at this point is people's self-censorship, where they're changing their art or they're catering their art to look more like the art of the times or about what is, you know, the conversation going on at the Whitney. Or my work's all very personal. You know, I believe in an immersive experience both in the studio and in situ when I'm studying it abroad.
When you talk about self-censorship of the day, do you believe political correctness has hurt our society in a lot of ways?
Oh, I really wouldn't want to even make a generalization there. I think that people's willingness to encounter is super important. And if you're encountering other cultures, alternative realities like that, you have to be willing to look at belief systems that aren't your own and to interface with that. I mean, there's 21st century, there's two ways to really get it on for me. I mean, you can get on the Facebook, you know, if you're afraid of flying, or you can actually go there, get a passport, man, and go check it out. It's a very, it's a full world. There's no shortage of things to paint about.
But before, there was only one way to get it on. You had to actually go there. And now, you can do it virtually.
Well,
so how has that changed the conversation?
That conversation, that's communications in general, is a leading indicator and facilitator right now in the world. We just now have the ability to instantly see what's going on in the streets of Syria or have the ability to follow one human rights person in China. There's an embedded responsibility with that access, and if it's can be done on, you know, I did a lot of work in the 80s with Amnesty International or with the American Indian Movement, whatever the time, it's certainly facilitated now much more than it was 20 or 30 years ago. And so that's going to have a shadow effect in my art.
Well, tell us about the shadow effect in your art that comes vis-a-vis National Voodoo Day in Benin. Before you take us to Benin and what National Voodoo Day was like, tell us about your fascination with the supernatural, with the voodoo, and where that comes from.
It really is a development from several decades of studies, beginning carnival celebrations in remote Mayan villages.
Doesn't everything begin that way?
Well, everything has an origin for sure. My fascination with it is that a lot of the arts that I'm participating in right now involve things that originally came culturally from there, whether it's the ostrich feathers I use in Mardi Gras or the cowbell that I hear Arne Young play in a jazz set, or it's the gris-gris that's coming up from New Orleans. These things all originated, you know, out of the diaspora from this particular region. And Benin is a fascinating place because 12, 15 years ago, it was a Marxist socialist state with the clamps down on religion, right? And since it has been renamed from Dahomey, which was the previous name, to Benin, it has experienced a flowering of culture that's phenomenal. And it's a mix of cultural interface you won't find elsewhere. I mean, 70 to 80% of the population are Vidone practitioners, and 30 to 40% of the population is Islamic. So there's a crossing and an interface there that's very peculiar. And it's fascinating. And there's a place there where it's the space between the beats where things can happen, whether that's in music or philosophy or science. You know, that's where your emerging ideas are going to occur. So it was a fascinating place for me to bring the sketch pad.
And you see the place between the beats, the Islamic influences, as well as the influences of the voodoo culture in some of those paintings in the exhibit.
Oh, absolutely.
I like African Chicken. It's very plain spoken on the campus, if you will. What was National Voodoo Day like in Benin? Take us there.
Yeah, I was over my head. Fantastic situation. I could describe, say, on one of the main parade grounds where there are already thousands of people gathered with music and festivities. You're on the water, you're at the edge of the ocean, red dirt soil, great smells in the air from the food and the people and the spices. And then suddenly groups began to enter the parade field in a competitive way where they're really strutting, right? And this is the chief of this tribe. And you can tell there's an umbrella over him and he's got his wives around him, and he's followed by his drum corps and his dancers and a few hundred people, and he's coming across the parade field this way, and there's a royalty from another tribe or literally the king of the country, or there's a strutting. There's a coming together of these various people. There's representatives from, I imagine, six countries, as well as traders, and all with their own rhythmic traditions, all with their own traditions of dress, all with their own deity within the pantheon of Vidone religion that they're revering. And so they're all bringing these offerings, and it's coming together. It's a celebration where that pantheon is conjoined in a celebration.
What was it like to sit there, and in essence, what you're telling me is you saw the grandfather of what you're seeing in Mardi Gras?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean,
that culture.
If you're in the second line parades, or you're seeing the Mardi Gras Indians come out and do these faux battles in New Orleans, which 100 years ago were not so faux. Knives were drawn. The same is true where I was at. This is where that tradition is coming from. And it's a phenomenal synchronization.
You're very much into that Creole culture. You have the patron saint of bad habits.
Oh, yeah, Creole. Kansas City was a Creole,
right.
Was considered a Creole city in the 17th century. I mean, the first the Chez de Kansas, you know, the house of the Kansas, the indigenous people here.
French traders on the river.
French traders on the river, right. It is a fantastic mix, and we've kind of lost some of that over the years, and yet maintain a surprising undercurrent that you can find in these exact things I'm talking about.
But you maintain that connection, and also your art has very frank conversations about what it means to be at that intersection as a white American man.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, I'm, you know, like you introduced me, I come from Long Prairie people. I had relatives fought on both sides of the Civil War, relatives fight street to street in New Orleans. The earliest slaveholding documents I found from my family were from Baltimore County, Maryland in 1684. So there's a long legacy, and I have to make sure and be willing to explore difficult truths and be willing to find the legacies that are worth keeping.
How do you walk the fine line between not, in a word, whitewashing, and then not, in a word,
whitewashing,
right,
yeah,
and not, in a word, being also a little bit too Kit Glovish and Sally Struthers?
Yeah, well, you got to be willing to take some hits, man.
Right.
You know, the art world, it's the one place where you put your name out there and people are going to let you know what they think. They like it, they don't like it. You say something interesting, you don't. You definitely don't want to be boring. You don't want to ask questions that have been overhashed. I look for corners that haven't been illuminated as brightly as I'd like.
One of the things that I found interesting is that you say the non-Eurocentric art values,
mm-hmm.
non-Eurocentric
right.
art values are
right.
an important part of your work.
Absolutely.
Explain that, and then why is that?
Well, I'm self-taught, up until the end of the 20th century and into now, a lot of the art values taught in schools, I didn't go to them, but were Eurocentric art values. And just for instance, a culture in Central America, the Tzotzil Maya, that I've immersed myself with many times, they don't have a word for art. Art's so integrated into their daily life that it's a part of just an existence, you know, whether it's lighting the fire or, you look at the Japanese, ikebana, you know, flower arranging, or the bonsai, or people that look at the culinary arts or the musical arts, where it's not been separated to become art about art or art for a rarefied class that can understand it. It's fully a part of the culture. And it's an ongoing fascination for me that I prefer the art that comes from culture more than I enjoy the culture that comes from art.
So immersing yourself in a Mayan village or working with a drill team
exactly.
or walking down the street with some ground beef
yeah.
with regular people.
Right, right.
More creativity comes from that than sitting in a gallery with all black on.
Well, I don't know if it's more creativity. It's just my own kind of creativity. I have a lot of respect for art and artists at all levels. I mean, there's more kinds of art than I know how to enjoy. And it's revelatory for both the maker or the appreciator in whatever that field. But for myself, I'm interested in perhaps a more complicated milieu.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabulani LaFall. Today's guest is an artist and Renaissance man, David Ford, whose exhibit is currently on display at the Dolphin Gallery in the West Bottoms. It's called I Love African Chicken. Now, you're a self-taught artist. How did you teach yourself?
Autodidacticism, I suppose.
yeah, that's how it works.
Yeah, you have to be willing to take on a differing view from what your initial inclination is in order to further that field of study. And I love to read, and I love to travel, and I've been the benefit of meeting many bright and influential people in my life. And you just remain open to it. I'm not done learning. I've got a I'm really working there. I'm practicing every day to be better. Yeah.
That's an interesting thing because your formal education ended when you dropped out of the Jesuit seminary at 15. Tell us about your journey after that and how you've been shaped all around from that experience.
Well, it's a long, winding road. Certainly there were a number of years that I can't say that I regret, but I was trying and involved with some pretty heavy activities, you know, working on the street, living on the street. Not too dissimilar from the art world where you're pimped and pimping, you know.
Right, right.
throughout the years and throughout some of the exposure that I've had to valuable voices, you further your practice and you develop relationships with gallerists or with curators who can see where your voice fits into the overall choral arrangement.
So School of Hard Knocks and
street-based
reading, writing, arithmetic,
sure.
No, R's.
When they had the Urban Peace Summit in Kansas City in the early 90s, it was the first time they had the coastal, quote-unquote, gang communities come together for the Urban Peace Summit. I did a lot of portraits of the participants and displayed them here through the UMKC campus. And at that point, that was much more my reality than the white world I'm in now. And to some degree, it still is. I mean, in Kansas City, I tend to display more like this Dolphin show of my 2 and 3D work, where oftentimes out of town I'm able to explore more performative or radical installation.
And speaking of performative and radical installations, tell us about your motivations as a provocateur. beginning with this story. The show right after 9/11 is now urban legend. Onions, meat, barking dogs, lawyers, bouncers. What was up with that?
I think that is urban legend because that's two shows mixed together. Right after 9/11, I did a 4,000 square foot installation in the Lidi Volkos art space that did involve the signing away of all your rights in order to enter, and that's something that I do regularly on shows in order to secure unusual spaces and do unusual things in them. Just to enter the exhibit, you would sign away your rights. You were photo documented, issued an identification badge. I had a series of lawyers in a cage who would overlook these documents and stamp them with approval. There was a delousing machine, so you'd be deloused, and then you were entered into a maze of chain link fencing and various vignettes of performers, all of which was just an elaborate framing device for a two-dimensional painting show in the back. I wanted to change people's perception before they encountered the art, so they weren't still thinking about their electric bill, or they weren't still, you know, wondering when the art started or not. To blur that art contact point is a tool that I use often in my installations.
Very allegorical tools as well, lawyers and cages and signing away your rights and things of that nature.
At that particular time, yeah, I mean, the Patriot Act and other developments were very active. These were topical issues.
How do you frame your performance art versus your visual art that's on canvas?
Well, over half of my performative work occurs outside the gallery context, occurs on the street, occurs as an intervention. The framing of that is simply being able to pull it off, being able to get the room on the credit card to finance it or the time in the day to do it. When they're hosted by galleries, it's usually framed by my past work. In the same way that you introduced it, you've done this, you've done this, I don't set out to be a provocateur, but I'm not afraid of taking on difficult issues.
And you have something coming up at the Nelson Atkins.
I do.
Along that line.
Yeah, I do. I'm very pleased with the new directorship at the Nelson and some of the programs. This particular one is an offshoot of Charlotte Street Foundation's 15th anniversary, where they've invited artists to lecture within the museum and explain or expose people to works that they found influential to their own work. And that liberty to speak and move around the museum should allow me other liberties in my presentation.
So when you talk about liberties in your presentation, when you sit down with Julian Zagazagoy, you know.
I've never sat down with
you
him.
Never
I got
sat
to
down
see him in
him,
the hallway once.
You got to see him in the hallway once. That was it.
I knew enough to say hello in Spanish. That was about it.
So your contacts there, you sit down with him. Do you say, I'm going to need a corn chip bag, some ketchup, and some paint, and I can't tell you what I'm going to do after that?
Yeah, that would be perhaps not in that institution, but that would be generally the way that I would approach that type of thing. They've been very nice. They've been doing a lot of research for me, a lot of library work on parts of their African collection and their Neapolitan holdings, and I look forward to furthering the discussion.
And speaking of the African collection, we had one of the curators here of
Nii.
Of that African collection that talked about the utility of indigenous art and the sort of melding of utility within what we call in the Western world art.
Right.
And that's the approach.
I heard that program. It's a great program, John Belani. And I'm pleased to have Nii in town. We're splitting him with the Detroit Museum part-time.
Right.
But it should enliven our collections. It's an interesting thing to separate art of a culture because it's different and it doesn't occur in the same two-dimensional realm, or it doesn't have a word for it as art, or it's used ritually rather than used just as a visual component. That type of questioning is an important part of the global art world right now. And it's starting to come across. You're starting to see collections. The piece that I'll be speaking about on Friday evening in that collection is from a chief that came up with his own art tradition. There was these ceramic vessels, these anthropomorphic vessels that he makes were not of his culture. He created that, and he actually created them as a form of commerce or a gift to visiting dignitaries. So there's as emerging and as fascinating of a practice and investigation, it's just that it's pedestaled differently.
What do you see? What fascinates you about the global art world right now? You mentioned the direction you thought it was going in. What fascinates you right now?
Oh, wow. Well, all of it. I'm very immersive. I really, what fascinates me about the art world right now?
Deep questions.
Yeah, that's a big one, man. That's a big one. We'll have to have a different guest answer that. I'm not sure I can.
What's sticking out for you right now?
For me right now, this recent trip to Africa, getting back to my studio today to paint, putting on that John Coltrane album or, you know, the new Snuff Jazz. It's the immersion in it. And I suppose that is a good question because it's what fascinates me is feeling it, where art isn't separate. It's not something you go do or you go encounter. It's a part of your life, you know. It's, you know, the food that you're eating in the morning or the conversation that you have. Kansas City is in a very rare place where we have access very casually in our lives to encounter, and it's just a willingness to encounter. And once you've crossed that threshold, then the subject matter that you encounter or the style that you encounter are just furtherances.
You grew up, by and large, in Kansas City, born and bred here. How do you identify yourself as an artist coming from Kansas City? You go other places.
816, man.
816 to the death, repping.
Yeah. Well, there's a special access here. This is a great town to make art. And for a while, that was just it. It wasn't a great town to be an artist. Slowly, the town is developing this infrastructure and these systems where to be a professional practitioner is also beneficial. But the access to square footage, the cost of living, the characters you can come and encounter with, the history that's untapped. I love my town. Civic booster.
You are a civic booster and an ambassador for Kansas City art as well. When you go other places, what's the perception of Kansas? Did you ever find yourself having to set people straight? Because you are the plain talking guy that sets people straight.
Kansas City, the biggest misnomer is that they think it's in Kansas, and that's all right. I say it's at the edge of Kansas, you know. People already have an idea about Kansas City because of Charlie Parker, because of Big Joe Turner and Count Basie, because of the Monarchs, you know, because of barbecue. And if you look at that, what do all those have in common? That all comes out of that same black diaspora that I'm trying to investigate with some of my paintings. Those movements, those contributions, cultural foundations of our city are grounded in a reality that we're yet to fully embrace.
Grounded in African chicken.
Hell yeah, I love it. I love African chicken.
What advice, David?
There's no white meat in African chicken.
Right.
Everybody's eating in the yard. It's just, tasty.
What advice do you have for young and emerging artists here around town?
Get a straight job.
Get a straight job.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
The way I approach my practice is I want to endow my practice. If I want to have cadmium red to paint with or I want to hire a dancer or an opera singer like I have for this weekend, you know, I want that ability. And to constantly put yourself in the position of as a charity or as a yearning to instead of actually being, Kansas City's benefit is that you can be. You can develop a space. You can develop a voice. You can become involved in a way that's just not accessible in a lot of cultures. And that's a responsibility. As much time as I spend in the third world, and the artists that I've spent time with there, they would yearn to have access to that same time to get a straight job and to be able to get a good canvas. Yeah.
Is a straight job different from a day job? Can we distinguish
that? I don't know. I like them all. I have a few jobs. I have a few separate jobs, and I love them all. And I think that they're interrelated, and art comes out of my life in any of the practices that I'm endeavored.
Is what you're saying, in essence, it doesn't have to be either or? You can incorporate everything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and I know there's very few professional artists in this town just making money off selling works. A lot of people are teaching or a lot of people are frying eggs or, you know, whatever it takes to get it done at the end of the day.
What's next for you after the Nelson Atkins walk, talk, and show that it's going to be?
Well, I have a very active year. It's been a fantastic season going on for me. I'm prepping and casting performers for an election night show November the 12th, I believe that'll be.
That's my birthday.
Yeah, and that'll be a big night. You can access my previous election night exhibit on the YouTube under I Like This Country.
Like a lot of stuff. Yeah, you like Indians? You like African chicken?
At that
chicken?
Point, that was politically incorrect sometimes, right, in the circles that I run in to say I like this country. And yet I'm a great patriot. So it's an investigation therein, and that will be the next large project I'll be
working on. So will you be playing off the live results?
Absolutely. The last time I had a cage fight, an announcer from the cage fights announcing the results between McCain and Obama. It will be very live.
Very live, and your work is very live. David's Ford's solo exhibition is I Like African Chicken. It's running, started running April 27th. It runs through June 23rd at the Dolphin Gallery in the Stockyards District of the West Bottoms. David Ford, thank you for joining us here on Central Standard today.
Thank you, Jablani.
And we're going to take a quick break. When we return, we go into the Freedom Schools Initiative with the Children's Defense Fund and learn all about how those initiatives are pushing education forward in our city. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. The concept of freedom schools has its origins in 1964, when members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, began teaching at schools in Mississippi as part of the movement for civil rights and voter registration. In 1995, that vision and tradition came to Kansas City, where the Children's Defense Fund created the first and to date most successful Freedom Schools Initiative. But the work doesn't end there, as we'll find out soon with our guests here. Joining us now are Reverend Darren Faulkner, Interim Executive Director for the Kansas City Freedom Schools Initiative, and Dr. Philip Hickman, who sits on the board of the National Children's Defense Fund Freedom Schools. And he's also the CEO and co-founder of Legacy Educational and Development, Inc. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell us about the history of the Freedom Schools Initiative. We learned a little bit about that in the intro there, but tell us more about the history here in Kansas City.
Well, the history of the Freedom Schools here in Kansas City can be traced back really to two, maybe three people. One of those persons is Mr. Dwayne Crumpton, and the other person would be Mr. Tom Roan, retired from the Kauffman Foundation. They were both at a conference in Venice, South Carolina, and had the opportunity to visit a workshop that was on the Freedom Schools. And both of them, not knowing they were, each of them were there, came back to Kansas City on fire and excited, called each other up and said, we've got to get a Freedom Schools here. At that point, they introduced the Freedom Schools program to Miss Carolyn Booker, and a longtime educator here in Kansas City. And she got on fire after seeing the program. And a couple of years later, we started the first Freedom Schools here in 1995.
Talk about this fire. Everybody's catching on fire. What spreads enthusiasm-wise?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's a combination of things. There's enthusiasm and excitement about learning, and you see that in the scholars, as we call our students. And that is contagious, even for adults, when you see the students, just the excitement that they have in reading books and wanting to learn as much as they can from the books. The other thing is our student-led, program, which is our college-age interns. They bring an excitement and enthusiasm that sometimes you don't see in teachers that are more seasoned in the classroom. And so between the excitement on the scholar's face about learning and the excitement on the college intern's face about teaching, there's a fire that you catch that you can't get rid of.
And one of the aspects of the fire that I notice is that really Freedom School hits at teaching the whole child. And with that, you see that learning becomes fun. And so it doesn't approach learning or education in a traditional sense, but it still has the same rigor and the same high standards as a traditional education system. But it's through fun activities, and it actually becomes contagious not only to those who are giving that information, but the scholars who are receiving the information.
Dr. Hickman, thank you for chiming in with us. I was going to ask you, how is the curriculum different in Freedom Schools? What differentiates it? What distinguishes it?
Well, the curriculum is different in the aspect of the information that we're giving to the kids as far as the language arts and the reading aspect of it. We not only strengthen the kids through culturally sensitive material, but like I said, the rigor and the standards actually go across just the Missouri standards. It's actually more of a nationwide curriculum that really hits at high standards and rigor. And also, it's the intent. The intent is not just for reading to read, but it's for reading to learn and to be able to gain knowledge, and also for a lifelong effort of reading.
Talk about that, the difference between reading to read versus reading to learn. Elaborate on that, if you will.
Well, I think as Dr. Hickman said, part of what Freedom Schools, what makes Freedom School is that we make learning fun. And while students in normal and traditional classrooms read, sometimes just to read, when you add the fun aspect to it with activities and culturally sensitive material, it makes not only it just something that they read, but it's something that they learn.
Fun is a good thing. What are some examples of how these reading experiences can go from reading to fun?
Well, we have something in our program called Harambe. It's a key Swahili term that means let's pull together. And as an educator, you may walk through our building, and in some classrooms you see students, they have their books out and the teacher's in front of them and they're reading together and they're discussing what they're reading. But then you may go to the next classroom and see students up dancing, singing, or chanting. And what has happened is they have a Freedom School break or praise break, and they go into Harambe. It's a way that it breaks up the monotony and refocuses and rechannels the kids to getting back to what they're supposed to be doing.
It's a lot like church, in a sense, isn't it, Reverend, where you have a call and response culture to the learning process?
Well, you know, we are not a religious organization, but I do think there are some similarities there. Absolutely.
Yes, there's a series of chants that, and like you said, call and response that are similar to that in the church in that aspect of the program. But it's really an eclectic approach to learning. And the difference is that you will see our children, and when we talk about reading to learn and we talk about reading as a lifelong effort, is that our kids continue to have books beyond the classroom. And I think that's the difference. When you're reading for a purpose, and that's to pass this test or to, you know, participate within the class is one thing. But when our children are reading books that extends beyond the classroom, and that's the contagious effort and fire that we instill in all our children.
Dr. Hickman, tell us a little bit more about how the Children's Defense Fund works with the local collaboration with Freedom Schools. How did that come about, and what does that entail?
Well, you have to understand that this is a nationwide effort. And so Freedom Schools are all over the nation. And am I correct? How many states?
There's Freedom Schools represented in some 29 different states. And last year we had some 150 Freedom Schools across the country.
Right. And so the Children's Defense Fund is sort of the mother program over the Freedom Schools within those states.
Now, the concept of Freedom Schools began in the civil rights era with the word freedom being operative and voter registration and empowerment and education among children of that era being the main goals. What is the role for Freedom Schools in the post-civil rights era, dealing with what we're dealing with now in modern times?
It's like I said before on other venues is that education, when you look at if there ever is a silver bullet in this world, we really have to look at education. It solves so many problems. And the ability for a child to read for knowledge and to read for enjoyment and to be able to participate in math at high levels, because our society is increasingly becoming technologically centered, that we're preparing the same thing. We're preparing kids with their God-given right to be able to be educated at a high level and to be able to compete in this global society.
You talk about the Children's Defense Fund's Freedom School being a national program. What makes the Kansas City initiative unique among that national program, Reverend?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is that our Freedom Schools have always been in churches. That's unique across the country in any city or state that you may go to. Most of the Freedom Schools across the country are in Boys and Girls Clubs, YMCAs. In community centers. But what has made us unique is we have been in churches for all of our 17 years of existence. Secondly, Freedom Schools in Kansas City has been innovative in a lot of ways. We have introduced, for example, junior interns. That was something that the national model then picked up and now teaches at their national training. Additionally, we have also introduced what we called, the name is escaping me right now, but Freedom Schools in Kansas City has been innovative in that we bring a lot of new things that the national office ends up adopting and making a national movement.
With the church being heavily involved, was that something that started out as a beginning, as a mandate, or something that happened by default, or you as a clergy just happened to be involved at that time? How did that come about?
Well, I think it goes back to the origin of Freedom Schools in Kansas City. Mr. Dwayne Crumpton took on the first Freedom Schools with KCMC, and then the Mount Pleasant Baptist Church got very much involved, and it was moved to the Mount Pleasant Baptist Church as a result. Reverend L. Henderson Bell, the great pastor there at Mount Pleasant, became the first executive director for Freedom Schools in Kansas City when that move took place.
And what's happening since then?
Freedom School in Kansas City has actually been one of the leading forefront Freedom Schools. When Marion Wright Edelman, when she looks to new initiatives, she actually looks to Kansas City to either be innovative, like he said, or to implement them. And so we're kind of considered one of the leading forces. And like he said before, we're a hidden jewel in our community because we aim to educate every child that comes through our doors.
So when the initiatives come down, Kansas City is the first city to put some of those ideas into implementation.
Or the reverse.
Right. Kansas City sets the standard. Right?
We set the standard, yes.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. We're talking about the Freedom Schools Initiative under the auspices of the Children's Defense Fund here in Kansas City. Our guests are the Reverend Darren Faulkner, Interim Executive Director of the Kansas City Freedom Schools Initiative, and Dr. Philip Hickman, who sits on the board of the National Children's Defense Fund, Freedom Schools Kansas City, and is CEO and co-founder of Legacy Educational and Development Incorporated. Tell us a little bit, Dr. Hickman, about your organization, Legacy Educational and Development Incorporated.
Well,
what are you setting out to do?
Yeah, Legacy is basically, we have a couple of nonprofit initiatives under our umbrella. And so one of them is that we have created a gifted academy because that's highly neglected within our communities. Actually, the research shows that the gifted population is actually the number one at-risk population now.
Why is that?
Because the education style that the classrooms still have where they have that a teacher is pouring empty knowledge into empty vessels does not work anymore. Our gifted kids are way more advanced, and they need to be stimulated in more than one way, and they're being disenfranchised within the school systems. The other one is a virtual academy in that we actually serve the needs of kids. It's an alternative virtual school that serves the needs of kids who have been suspended from school or kids who have not been successful in traditional alternative programs. So it's just more of a creative way to educate our children. That's something that we have to do nowadays is become creative to reach all our kids.
Reverend Faulkner, based on your experience and what you've seen, and I'll redirect this question to Dr. Hickman after you answer it, what would you say is the biggest challenge Kansas City faces in terms of education? Big question, but what do you think?
I think it's a huge question that doesn't have a simple answer. I think it's a multiplicity of issues that Kansas City faces when it comes to education. I think the first issue is what's not occurring in the home. We have some responsibility as a community. We have some responsibility in our homes before our children ever get to school. And then once the children get to school, as Dr. Hickman said, the school district is responsible for teaching in new and more innovative ways to keep our students engaged. So there's not a simple answer to your question, but I do believe
it begins in the home, and you said multiplicity. What would be next after the home?
I think after the home, we have to, as a community, embrace our children. Our motto for this event on Thursday is Saving Kansas City's Sixth Child. And what that means is there's the sixth child sometimes is left out or forgotten. And we have to embrace our children holistically as a community once we have gotten it under control in our homes.
Yeah, one of the things that America is good for is kind of turning our backs on our children. And we kind of succeeded in that in Kansas City. If you look at as far as the dropout rate and the graduation rate of our children in Kansas City. And one of the things that we're just creating, the biggest problem, I think, is actually a whole community problem, is that we don't see it as a whole, that it's everyone's problem. Education affects everyone. Crime, business, you know, to put an educated workforce out, starvation, obesity, all those kind of things, education is important. This is the kind of issues that we tackle at Freedom School. The other thing is leadership. We have a Saturday Leadership Academy. We had a partnership with Hickman Mills, and Reverend Faulkner was instrumental in that.
We had a great partnership with the Hickman Mills School District in providing Saturday Leadership Academy. And we used the curriculum, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective Teens by Sean Covey. It's a great curriculum, teaches leadership development, teaches taking responsibility, time management, you name it, all those extra soft skills that you don't always get taught in your average everyday classroom.
Tell us about this concept of getting back to the sixth child. Who is Kansas City's sixth child? It comes from the Children's Defense Fund's mantra that one out of every six children is forgotten or left behind. Who is Kansas City's sixth child, and how are we addressing that?
I think Kansas City's sixth child is, in this case, our entire Kansas City, Missouri school district.
Wow.
And how Freedom Schools is addressing that is we serve in the summer as that bridge from one semester to the next semester when learning generally doesn't take place. In fact, research shows that students have a summer slide in terms of their education. And Freedom Schools serves as a niche, in fact, a very good niche. Not only do we prevent the summer slide, but research shows that in most cases, students in our program show gains over the summer.
Right. And the sixth child is, like you said, is every child. When we look at education as a whole and we're developing partnerships like Freedom School to work with Kansas City Public School District, we're really looking at the fact that, you know, we're creating dropout factories. You know, when 47 to 49% of the kids drop out. And we have a new administration with the school district that is working closely with us to prevent these things from happening. And it extends beyond Kansas City. You know, we're focusing on the Kansas City kids, but Kansas City and the greater Kansas City area, we have to look at that these children are becoming increasingly mobile. And so they're moving out of the Kansas City school district and they're going to other areas that we will, quote unquote, call suburban school districts. And they're becoming six children in that area also because they're still increasingly dropping out of no matter what school we're coming to. So when we're talking about the sixth child, we're talking about educating every child.
What does high-quality academic enrichment mean? It comes from your materials. It comes from your mandate. How do you implement that?
Well, we implement it because, first of all, when we say high quality and we're talking a real strong, rigorous program, we're talking beyond grade level. So if we have a fifth grade child, our goal is to educate that child and bring them beyond grade level. Now, obviously, we have situations where we have children that are 2 and 3 and 4 grade levels below. But what we do differently is we keep that standard above grade level and we build in the compensatory skills that are necessary for that child to get up to that level. So our belief is not that these children cannot achieve. We believe that they just have untapped potential, and we meet them with their compensatory skills. But like I said, we always expose them to grade level and above expectations.
What are compensatory skills? What compensatory skills do you put in?
Here's an example. We have an increasing amount of kids who cannot read. But that spills over to different areas. But if you talk to them verbally, they can comprehend. And so when you look at reading, you have to look at reading, basic reading and reading comprehension. And so we expose the kids to upper grade level comprehension, maybe read it to them, maybe go through the book. But then in the process, we're hitting at their compensatory skills, which are lack of phonics, lack of phonemic awareness, lack of word attack and decoding and those kind of things. And so once they learn those skills that they didn't learn before, then they quickly increase to a higher level standard because now that they can read and we didn't dumb down the curriculum by giving them a lower level comprehension skills, and therefore it all catches up to them.
So reading comprehension allows you to go from reading to read to reading to learn. That's
absolutely
the point that he's trying to make. There's also another salient point in your curriculum that I'd like to touch upon, and that's nutrition, health, and mental health. You hear from a lot of teachers that it's hard for a young child to learn when they're not even properly nourished to begin with, showing up at the school. So talk about the nutrition, health, and mental health component of that.
Well, that's a good question. There are basically five pillars of the Freedom School program that address that those very areas. Freedom School is based on giving our scholars a healthy start, a head start, a fair start, a safe start, and a moral start. And to deal with those first two, the healthy start has more to do with than just nutrition. Healthy start has everything to do with lifestyles of our kids and the environment in which they grow up, but it also has to do with the meals that they get. In our program, we provide a breakfast, lunch, and a snack. And each one of those meals must meet USDA nutritional standards. And so we make sure that those guidelines are in place and they're able to get a healthy start. But then we also focus on giving them a head start. A lot of times, as Dr. Hickman has already indicated, our children tend to be somewhat behind in grade level reading. And so we pride ourselves in giving them the keys, as he said, to increase their learning, but in a fun way that makes it lasting.
Right. And you got to understand that we are creating an obese nation.
Right.
And with those are different consequences. And actually, it actually affects the brain, the myelin sheath in the brain. And it affects cognitive development and those kind of things. And we're killing our kids. And so one of the things that Freedom School, not only do we provide healthy lunches and we talk about it. And so it can be a lifestyle change and not just a program change. One of the statistical facts of Freedom School that is very important is what Reverend Faulkner was saying, is that when our urban youth approach school, that they already approach school 2 years behind. They approach school with a disadvantage. And then when they come to their regular peers in more of a professional household or middle-class household, and when they come to summer, that they actually drop back 2 more years. So within their first couple of years of school, they're already 4 years behind. And guess what? It increases. And so by the time that child is in third grade or eighth grade, that child is hard to close that gap without quality summer programs. And if you really look at Kansas City as a whole, when you start thinking about what programs that we have for our youth, we have to get the word out. We have to get the word out that this is a free program. It's a no charge program for kids in Kansas City, Missouri School District, and that we provide all these quality services, quality food, and quality enrichment for kids.
So tell us about the summer program. When does it start? What does it entail? And what will be different this summer?
Our Freedom School program starts this year, June 18th, and it will run 6 weeks through July 27th. What will be different this year is we have added certified teachers to our model, and certified teachers this year will be providing a math component. We have had math before in partnerships that we have had with school districts in the metropolitan area, but this year we have selected our own math teachers, and a math component will be added. So that will be different this year. Along with the State Summer School Partnership, in the addition of teachers, we have extended our day by another hour. So an additional hour of instruction will take place this summer, which enhances, again, more time in the classroom, gives them an opportunity to learn more as they go through the summer.
Are you looking for certain students, or do you accept pretty much every student that comes to you?
We accept just about any student that comes to us. Open to anyone. In fact, we have students that come from other states in the summer that stay with their grandparents, stay with their relatives that live in Mississippi, Tennessee, you name it. So we're open to receiving anyone this year.
And I should mention that you're still accepting students.
We are still accepting students. I will say that enrollment has begun to fill up at a lot of our sites, but there are a few slots still available.
Now, the keynote speaker at the event, Saving Kansas City's Sixth Child, a recommitment to reaching and teaching The Children Left Behind is going to be headlined by Jeffrey Canada. What can we learn from Jeffrey Canada's experiment with education in Harlem depicted in Waiting for Superman?
Well, obviously, if you look at Kansas City, we tried, under the leadership of former Mayor Funkhauser, we tried to initiate a Freedom School in Kansas City. And one of the things with the Big Five, we're looking at, not a Freedom School, I'm sorry, Harlem Children's Renaissance, and we're looking at it with the Big Five initiative right now in Kansas City is revitalizing an urban initiative. It's kind of taking a neighborhood and taking a school district and educating a whole child from there, from birth on up.
So a similar children's improvement zone idea.
Right. But one of the things that we can take away, really implement in Kansas City, that first of all, it's a totality of services, wraparound services. So we have to look at looking at kids from birth. And we look at what we're providing services to that mom for the benefit of that child, and how can we educate? And then, you know, when the kids come to school, how can we have quality preschools? Because that's one of the things that we're lacking in Kansas City, too, is that early childhood development. Once we set the basis and the ground rules, then we can go from there.
And given the, shall we say, intrigue going on with Kansas City Public Schools now, how do these initiatives fit into that?
Well, I think the Kansas City Freedom School Initiative has always been, I call it a niche for the Kansas City, Missouri School District particularly, but for districts all around, because our kids come from every district all around. I think that we continue to do the work that we do this year with the addition of certified teachers and adding math. We continue to support each district in the metropolitan area with what we do in the summer.
Right, and we have to really, in efforts of time, we have to really understand that Jeffrey Kennedy is the chair of the Children's Defense Fund. So he's also a product of Freedom School. And also understand that when he comes to us and speak, is not just necessarily education. He is the top 100 most influential person in the world. So everyone needs to come and hear his message.
And the upcoming event is called Saving Kansas City's Sixth Child, A Recommitment to Reaching and Teaching the Children Left Behind. It will feature Harlem Children's Zone President and Chief Executive Officer Jeffrey Canada on Thursday, May 10th at 11 a.m. at the Westin Crown Center Hotel. Our guests here in the studio are Reverend Darren Faulkner. He's the interim executive for Kansas City Freedom Schools Initiative, plus Dr. Philip Hickman, who sits on the board of the National Children's Defense Fund Freedom Schools, and is also the CEO and co-founder of Legacy Educational and Development Incorporated. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming.
Thank you so much for having us.
And thank you.
And tune in tomorrow when we take you inside a new exhibit at the Wyandotte County Historical Museum titled For All the World to See, Visual Culture and the Struggle for Civil Rights. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi with help from Charlie Upchurch. Up to Date is next with The Political Pundits. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day. Thank you.